Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is the first Red Eyes Radio Show for the year 2016. Looking forward to this year. A lot of new exciting things coming up, and I also think there's going to be plenty of waves of discontent to both surf and also steer in the right direction. The opposition to the PC, liberal, degenerative Marxist culture is growing tremendously, and this year it's going to reach new heights. That's why you're also going to see new attempts by government and media to not only smear it and silence it, but attempts to destroy it, to break it up from the inside, to shut it down. Now, don't be disheartened when this happens. This is a good sign. Trust me, this is something we can work with. Whether you're a neo-reactionary, anti-communist, alt-right, or 1488, or a truth seeker for true free speech and freedom of inquiry, I consider you all an ally. There are other factions and branches to this, too, that I could mention as well, but I hope you get what I'm saying. You know, a general opposition to the establishment and the internationalists. Now, whether you're a traditionalist or a revolutionary, a Christian, a pagan, an atheist, we need all, and there's no reason to spend time turning the barrels on each other. Considering what we're facing and the resources that they have at their disposal, we need multiple divisions mounting offensives on multiple fronts. So keep focus on the enemy and keep your eye on the ball. Today we're going to speak with a libertarian ally, if you will, Chris Cantwell. He's doing some great work with his show Radical Agenda, vehemently fighting political correctness, who's fed up with the BS. Christopher Cantwell is an activist, writer, talk show host, and satirist originally from New York, now living in New Hampshire. He hosts the Radical Agenda, as I said, 3 days a week, discussing news and issues from a pro-white anarcho-capitalist perspective. Chris is the former co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Free Talk Live, and his writings has been syndicated on Lou Rockwell, Economic Policy Journal, A Voice for Men, and numerous other publications pertaining to philosophy, politics, economics, race, and gender issues. Stay tuned. Good show up ahead. Chris Cantwell, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to connect with you. Hope you're doing well today.
Likewise. It's great to be with you, and I'm doing quite well. I hope you are as well.
Absolutely. Lots going on as usual, of course. Yeah, it's great to connect with you. I mean, I've been listening to a bunch of your shows, Radical Agenda. You're in New Hampshire, where it's looked into the demographics today, 93.9% white, according to a 2010 census. So perhaps that's why you guys have the Free State Project up there. But we'll get into that a bit later. But tell us about, one thing I like is you introduce the show, you say common sense extremism. Now explain that to us a little bit.
Well, yeah, I came up with that sort of catch line for the show because, of course, I find myself in a position where I'm saying things that I think to be eminently reasonable, and people call me some kind of crazy extremist. So if that is the society that we live in, where saying something that is common sense is deemed radical and dangerous, well, then I'm perfectly happy to be a radical and dangerous person. And so I came up with common sense extremism, and it seems to have gone over pretty well.
So how long have you been doing the show for?
I've been doing the show in its current format. I've only been doing it. We're up to episode 83 at the time of this show. But I've been podcasting since like 2013. We started it off as more of a comedic podcast. We called it Some Garbage Podcast as sort of a self-deprecating name. It was a business partner of mine and I when I was still living in New York. And we started it off as we were having chats after work in the office and we were laughing greatly and we decided to share that with other people. And as I started discussing more serious topics and having better guests on the program, I decided it was time for a rebranding. And earlier this year, I changed it to Radical Agenda.
Right. Very good. Now, tell us a bit about your background a bit. It's always interesting to hear, before we kind of dive deeper into some of the topics too, we can know a little bit more about where you're coming from and whatnot. But you did a show previously, obviously, with a couple of other guys up in New Hampshire, I guess. And I guess things fell apart or whatever. Do you want to run through that for us?
Yeah, so I moved to New Hampshire originally in 2012 as something known as the Free State Project, as you had mentioned. Okay, so the Free State Project is a political migration here in New Hampshire to try to get people who are liberty-oriented, libertarians, to come to the same place and try to build a freer world. Because as you're certainly aware, around the world and within the United States, there's less and less freedom. So I had moved here originally in 2012 as part of that particular effort. I had a falling out with that organization over some political differences in strategy. I had mentioned that, in my opinion, that there would be violence between free men and agents of the state, and they were very frightened by that. And I left for a while. I came back last year, and I ended up co-hosting a broadcast radio show by the name of Free Talk Live. And so I had been doing Free Talk Live for the better part of a year, and there was an issue came up. A guy by the name of Stefan Molyneux is a content producer I'm a big fan of, and he put out a video about race and IQ. And it was an honest intellectual inquiry into the subject. I thought it was very scientific. And somebody had posted this video to a Facebook group for financial supporters of the program. And when they did that, they just outright labeled this guy a bigot and a racist. And I said, well, now hang on a second. Can we sort of parse through the evidence here? And as I did that, I was then labeled a racist. And I thought that that was really pretty ridiculous, and I wouldn't back away from it. And so I was fired from the program, which led to which led me down, you know, a little bit of a rabbit hole, sort of looking into the race issues, because I said, well, now I need to win the argument, right? So I started looking into all of these things, and it really really sort of blew my mind, if I'm honest with you.
Well, there's a lot to it there, and I guess to a certain extent, although not the effects or the fallout was the same for us, we're also very much into, well, I guess libertarianism for maybe years, kind of like a passing phase, really, to a certain extent, but it bridged on very quickly from, like, you know, understanding that something is wrong in society. What do we do about it? What works? What doesn't? And I think it's quite common to get this idea that, well, just as long as we get the government out of our business, things are going to be, you know, work out well or whatever. And then the racial aspect to this, coupled with mass immigration, and, you know, me being from Sweden and whatnot, I've seen my country being radically transformed during my lifetime, specifically during the late 90s and the 2000s. But the idea there is that there's a lot of things, you know, to this that I think people on the libertarian branch of things are not looking into, and the... Perhaps maybe because they don't dare, or they just simply don't believe in it. It's kind of an equality kind of line of thinking that still kind of lingers within that. But tell us a bit more about that in terms of how libertarianism for you kind of clashed, or if it clashed with kind of the things you're starting to find out when it comes to difference and race realism and all that kind of stuff.
So I do not believe that libertarianism... it clashes with it in the slightest. I do believe that libertarians clash, and I'll try to clarify that difference. You know, if you read Hans Hermann Hoppe, if you read Murray Rothbard, these guys were very, speaking in past tense about Rothbard, but obviously present tense about Hoppe. These guys explain how the world can work in a libertarian way. And they are not saying that this is going to be some fantastic egalitarian society where nobody uses force. They're making very intellectual arguments here. What you have is a lot of sophistry in libertarians. And and I've theorized that this has to do with as I sort of looked into the R versus K thing, the RK selection theory. I read the book by anonymous conservative recently, and one of the things he brings up is, you know, the R selected, or the liberals in the civilization, will sort of be more prone to novelty seeking. And so I think that liberals have made common cause with libertarians in a lot of cases over social issues and that sort of thing. And for that reason, we've been sort of overrun with leftists, essentially, who are in libertarian social circles because it's a place for them to be big fish in a little pond and that sort of thing. But they are not; these are not intellectual people who really understand the philosophy of libertarianism as has been laid out by the actual intellectuals who laid out the philosophy. So when we talk about, you know, immigration, for example, the idea that we're supposed to have open borders, well, that's not the ideas that were laid out by Murray Rothbard or Hans Hoppe. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a private property society where borders are the whole point. The idea that you would be overrun with unwashed masses from third world war-torn countries who just come across with nothing and then leech off of the civilization. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's as anti-libertarian as a thing can get. And so I would agree that, yes, the majority opinion amongst libertarians is open borders, but it's a flawed way of looking at things born out of people who have not bothered to read the literature.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, because it definitely feels like that has, you know, snuck in there, if you will, for lack of a better term. I remember a while back looking at, you know, the very basic ideas from, you know, from Milton Friedman to, many of these people who, you know, advocate free market, basically. And this idea that if we have, you know, freedom of goods and free market, there shouldn't be any difference in terms of the free movement of people, right? That they can go wherever they want to, they can move into society where jobs are needed, etc. But where would you say that this derailed then, or that the aspect of mass immigration became, tied in with basically the kind of global market structure that we have today, that somehow, you know, borders is an old antiquated idea? Is that something that came out of a different philosophy and kind of attached itself to what the libertarians think, or how do we explain that, do you think?
Well, I guess it helps if we differentiate libertarians, right? So if I have to describe myself as what sort of libertarian I am, I would say I'm a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist. If you read Murray Rothbard, he was no stranger to conflict with guys like Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman would also say that you should have what he referred to as a minimum negative income tax, which some people would refer to as a basic income guarantee, that sort of thing. They had a lot of disagreements, and I imagine that would be one of them. I mean, Milton Friedman, I do not believe, was philosophically an anarchist, whereas Murray Rothbard was. When I talk about libertarianism, I'm talking about a society where there isn't a government to create a border, but at the same time, everything is privately owned, and thus you can't just scroll through other people's property without their permission, right? Now, we're far away from that, and I'm certainly not trying to suggest that government should try to operate in the way that I see a libertarian society operating. That's impossible. But in a perfect world, from a philosophical point of view, if you will, these things would all be privately owned, and then we wouldn't have these, you know, these conflicts. But in the absence of that idyllic perfect world, you know, Murray Rothbard has an article out by the title of Nations by Consent, and he renounces the idea that you would just be, you know, overrun with people from third world countries. So there's no shortage of difference of opinion between people who would classify themselves as libertarians. But I would go so far as to say that the orthodoxy, if you will, of the libertarian philosophy would be best read from guys like Rothbard and Hoppe.
Right. Yeah, well, exactly. There, I understand that definitely there's, differences between people, what they think, and different, branches, as there always are in this. Tell us a bit about the Free State Project. We can return to this a bit later, but tell us, what attracted you to that initially, and then was it true where you were expelled from that, or what happened there?
Yeah, so what initially attracted me to it, I mean, I found myself in a little bit of legal trouble in 2009, and this led me to studying law and the Constitution and the history of this country and that sort of thing, and I came to the conclusion that the government, which I live under, did not in any way represent the government that was promised to us by the purported founding fathers. And I became very upset about that, and this led me on a bit of a philosophical journey that has us having this conversation now. And during the course of that, I found libertarianism. I found a guy by the name of Michael Bednarik. He was a 2004 presidential candidate, had introduction to the Constitution, whatever. This leads me on a philosophical journey, and I find the Free State Project. I was living in New York at the time. And, of course, if somebody is interested in freedom, New York's not a very good place to be. And so as I set out to find another place where I could live more free and have guns and low taxes and that sort of thing, I found the Free State Project, and I moved here originally in 2012. As far as my expulsion from that, there was an incident that happened. Concord is the state capital here, and Concord Police Department wanted to get an armored personnel carrier, something known as a Bearcat, made by a company known as Lenco. And the Concord Police Department applied to the United States Department of Homeland Security for a grant to obtain this armored personnel carrier. And when they did that, they said that they had a domestic terrorist problem in the state, which is ridiculous. There's no crime here, much less terrorism. But they said to the Department of Homeland Security they had a domestic terrorist problem, and they cited Free Staters, members of the Free State Project, as this terrorist problem. And this was found out by a Freedom of Information Act request by an activist here, and he published it. And I said to the people here, I said, well, you know, the government is waging a war on terrorism. They just labeled you a terrorist, and they bought a two-ton war machine with the specific intent of using it against you. You might want to start thinking about defending yourself against these government agents. And I'll say it plainly, I meant by using violence against them. And this, of course, scares people because they're being labeled terrorists, and now you're talking about going to war with the government. And this this frightened a whole bunch of people, and so they had expelled me from the organization.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I said, New Hampshire is about 93.9% white. I think it was 2010 census or something. But now let's kind of just get into that. And if you think that that in itself has anything to do with the fact that something like the Free State Project is in existence in New Hampshire.
I certainly don't think it hurts. And one of the problems that I have with the Free State Project as it stands is that you do have these left-wing people in it who they see this actually as a problem, right? So their whole thing is, well, we've got to recruit more women. We've got to recruit more minorities. We need more diversity because they think that's going to be fantastic. And I couldn't disagree with them more. I don't think it's a coincidence that most libertarians are white males. I think that they should, you know, sort of embrace that and cater to their demographic instead of jumping on board with this whole, you know, white male privilege nonsense and trying to dilute things. And they're making some mistakes in that. But obviously, when you have a largely homogenous society, as we largely have here, you have less conflict. And so there are people who would seek to create diversity, but diversity leads to adversity, as we've seen in many a place. And I'm not looking forward to that at all.
Yeah, well, it's so true. That's what's so ironic about all this too, that it seems like, you know, places like Oregon and Washington, these places were you know, fairly white in comparison to many other states. That's where you get a kind of a liberalism which is you know, seeking to replace those very same white people that have been there to kind of enable that liberalism to begin with. This is a very strange kind of what's happening there in terms of how they seek to replace themselves. Because I think that if we talk about this population replacement that's going on with mass immigration and low birth rates of whites, etc., I think that some of these ideas in itself, both libertarianism but also liberalism in itself, would not function basically these have not popped up in as far as I know anywhere in any other part of the world that you know doesn't have any white people. I don't know, do you know of any such place?
No, I cannot say that I do. I mean, I'm a big fan of Stefan Molyneux, and he often uses the phrase the Freedom Club, sort of these regions of the world where they have tried to have governments that operate on reason to the extent that a government is capable of doing that. And it does not seem like that is going on in many of the places where mass immigration is coming from. And of course, you know, mass immigration itself seems to be like a government program that they are sending out sort of economic signals to invite people in to replace their populations. And it seems catastrophically destructive. And I do think that there's, if you will, I don't want to say conspiracy, but an agenda there to do that.
Well, of course,
It empowers governments. Governments want power. And so they say, hey, these people from over there who have made this catastrophically ridiculous government, they can come into the society and they'll empower us to do anything we want.
Right. Exactly. And then on top of that, you have, of course, the business world, the capitalists, if you will, that are intricately tied into this as well. We had, Anne Corcoran with us from Refugee Resettlement Watch, and she had been, basically detailing all these places in I think it was Idaho and a couple of other, I think it was some places in Montana too, traditionally very white states where there was, you know, various businesses and various industries in those areas that were actively, lobbying for shipping in refugees, right? Some of them were working in these like meat packing facilities and all this kind of stuff. And they're getting, you know, basically cheap labor out of this. So it seems like the left-wing idea of kind of, I guess, gaining votes and having a democratic or left-leaning government. They want to have it for that reason. And then you have businesses or the capitalists that you think that these people on some level would oppose is also kind of taking advantage of this situation and getting low-cost labor, basically. So it's like a sinister marriage between these two forces.
I agree with your assessment, but I would add the caveat that I believe that the businesses are reacting to a perverse economic incentive created by the governments themselves, right? So the government encourages the immigration, and then, of course, their competitors then gain access to this cheap labor, and then they want to compete with their competitors, and thus they end up bringing all of these people in. And so I believe that the businesses are reacting to an economic incentive that is sort of imposed on them by the state. But certainly, I mean, cheap labor is certainly an attractive thing. My vision of it, just to be, in my effort to stand up for free markets and libertarianism, my clinging to the idea that the big businessman is the last oppressed minority, I do think that absent these sort of state controls, these state interventions, I don't think that incentive would necessarily be there, because, of course, they would say they were to sponsor the importation of people into a place. It would cost them a great deal of money to do that in the first place. And then without the state to provide welfare benefits and that sort of thing for underpaid workers, as often happens here. I mean, people who complain about minimum wage and that sort of thing, they will say, oh, well, they don't pay these workers enough, and then they collect state benefits. I'm like, well, if the state didn't provide them with those benefits, then they wouldn't work, and then there wouldn't be the incentive to do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, my critique of libertarianism, or I guess many libertarians, is this aspect that, along the line, as I was getting, more and more aware of immigration, how it's being used, I was getting aware of, for example, how the United Nations are running programs of population replacement, referencing, these reports that was released early in the millennium, that basically, advocate for the replacement of the population. It's quite open. I mean, it is a conspiracy in the sense that, there are agreements between people. Conspiracy just means to breathe or to conspire together or to, make an agreement, basically. But it's happened out in the open, unless, of course, you bring attention to it and say that it's going on, then they deny that it's actually happening and that you're crazy for, like, recognizing or seeing this, despite that you can actually go and look this up for yourself. But what happened is that, I started to realize that many libertarians didn't seem to understand that, ultimately, although as I said, in terms of the business is gaining from this as well, I mean, mass immigration is an idea that's enforced by the state. We have never had, as far as I know, a chance to vote on these issues in the Western world where we can make a decision democratically, if we want to be replaced, if we want to have more people come into, our nations, etc. So it's something that is being, forced upon the people of a country. Yet very few libertarians actually kind of speak up against it. With you're not included in that, of course. But why do you think that is, and why is it that they can't seem to grasp that this is something that's being enforced by the state?
I think that there's a number of things to it. For one, I mean, it's complicated, right? So libertarians, unfortunately, what you've had in libertarianism is that there's efforts to grow their ranks, right? And so, especially in a place like New Hampshire, where we're actually trying to take action to do something. So, as a part of a political migration, you would think that they of all people would understand what immigration does, right? Our entire point is to come to this place, take over the government, and fundamentally alter the way of life in this state.
Right.
So you would think that they would understand what immigration does to a place, but for some reason they think it's going to be a fantastic idea to import a bunch of communists, socialists, and theocrats from third world countries, right? Yep. And they don't, their idea is that you're going to bring 20,000 libertarians to New Hampshire and then you're going to have a free state. But if you bring a million Muslims in, you're not going to have an Islamic state. It's the stupidest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what has happened with libertarians is that I think that libertarianism will always be like a minority political philosophy. And that goes into sort of the RK selection theory thing. But since that is the case, what happens is they try to make common cause with other people. And as I mentioned earlier, they seem to have an easier time doing that with liberals than with conservatives. I'm a guy who came into getting politically involved through the Tea Party here. And so I've always been a more conservative guy. And when I found libertarianism, I said, well, you know, if I stand up for other people's freedom, then I'll probably have more freedom. And thus I logically became a libertarian, but I'm a right winger in my brain. And so what has happened is they've tried to make common cause with liberals. And that's easy to do because they just talk about things like sex and marijuana, and this appeals to people. And right. Then they have a bunch of liberals in their midst. And as you might be aware, when you're dealing with left wingers, you're not always dealing with the most intelligent of people, and they're not thinking things all the way through to their ultimate logical conclusion.
Of course not. It's all very emotional, not very rational, and statistics and all that stuff. Well, they use it sometimes, of course, to present an image that they want to. But, you know, I just want to mention this. Well, we had Libertarian Realist with us a while back, too. And I know that you've talked with him as well. And I'm kind of asking similar questions here because in the same realm, and it's interesting to hear what, you know, your take on some of these things are. But one of the points I'm, you know, made to him is that I don't think that libertarianism is that it's strong enough in terms of those kinds of conditions that's being created both in Europe and also America when it comes to mass immigration. Just as you said, in terms of, you know, Islam, it's not as bad in America, although it's quite a bit too. It's growing there too. But there's a huge, you know, Islamic Arab population in Europe right now. And obviously they will, I think they will use the democratic process if they can. If they become, or when, with current trends, when they become a majority, they'll obviously use this against us, right? They'll use the democratic process to turn it into, you know, some Sharia law zone or something like that. And I just see that libertarianism as a kind of an antidote to that is just not going to function and work. It even seems to me that even if you had enclaves of libertarians in certain areas, it seems to me that the conditions that's being created right now with heightened terrorism, heightened insecurity, heightened violence, rapes, all of it is just going skyrocketing right now. And it's almost like that all they would do would be a result to try to defend their own property, basically. And they wouldn't be able to function as a society anymore. I don't know. What's your thoughts on this? I mean, it's a huge area and a huge, you know, complex topic. We can break it down a bit if you want to, in terms of how, you know, if libertarianism is something that can, you know, stand a chance against something like Islam, if they are, you know, demographically more than us Westerners.
So I would say that if you had a population of people who were very well educated, who had read Ludwig von Mises and Hans Hermann Hoppe and Murray Rothbard, and that was the majority of the population, you would not have any problems with foreign invasion or anything like that. Unfortunately, I just don't think that you're going to have that. And it's unfortunate because I do think that, you know, the philosophy laid out by brilliant minds like them is able to stand up to these things. Unfortunately, these ideas don't appeal to most people. And you really would have to study them a great deal to understand them thoroughly. And most people are just never going to do that. And so is a great piece by Anonymous Conservative where he writes, he says, you know, libertarianism will always be a minority philosophy. And I'm sure you've gone over the RK selection theory thing on here mm-hmm. before. I don't know if we need to break that down your listening.
Do that for us quickly if you can. It would actually be great, Chris.
Okay, so I just finished reading this book not too long ago, and it was one of the things that has really rocked my world for you as of late. So RK selection theory is a thing about breeding strategies. So you'll say on the R side is like a mathematical symbol, which stands for creating more offspring. You can think of in the animal population that would relate to like rabbits, that they would breed more or less indiscriminately, not invest a great deal into raising their children. And there are certain behaviors that are going to go along with that. On the other side of the spectrum is K, where you will have a greater investment in the raising of the offspring. And this would result in fewer offspring, but they will raise fitter offspring. And that is their reproductive strategy to pass on their DNA as best as possible. And that would be wolves and animals of that variety. Human beings are, largely K-selective just by the nature of our breeding process. We obviously have a long gestation period. There's massive amounts of resources go into raising children. But one of the reasons that human beings are the undisputed ruling species of this planet for the time being is that we're very capable of adapting. And so in response to copious amounts of resources, people will lean more towards our selective reproductive strategy, will there sort of be more promiscuous and breed less discriminately, and that will carry with it certain behaviors. Now, where this relates to is, so those our selective behaviors will tend to be more with liberals, right? Left-wing people who are just like, okay, I want to have an environment of equality. I'm not going to care much for property rights. We're just going to be like rabbits in a field where we just have sex and eat clover and don't really need to think about very much. Whereas, you know, your conservatives are people who don't mind competition. They will protect territory. They will fight to defend things and that sort of thing. And they will breed in smaller numbers, but they will invest more into their offspring. Now, where this relates to libertarianism, as Anonymous Conservative brings up, is that he says, okay, there is an offset of this, that R and K come as a result of population density, and that you might well have people who are, say, living off where they're not coming into contact with people as frequently, and thus they would find it aberrant that you would have judgments of sexual behaviors and expect cooperation with certain things and whatnot. And so this would obviously, just evolutionary psychology speaking, this would be a very small minority of the population, and that would sort of explain why there's so many liberals, so many conservatives, and so few libertarians. And so when looked at from that perspective, it makes sense to me that you're going to have, you know, that libertarians are going to be a minority political philosophy.
Right, exactly. And let's kind of put that in perspective to what I mentioned about Islam or you know, the growing Muslim population in Europe. How do you think that plays into it? Are we simply being bred out of existence? I mean, you have imams that are openly talking about, you know, basically higher birth rates is going to lead to our, you know, dominating the continent in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's very scary. And I think that it's crazy that you have, and I'm certain it's going on by you too, and that's how you find yourselves in this. I mean, what's going on in Europe is part of what sort of red-pilled me to the immigration thing to begin with.
Right.
And so as I look over here, you know, if you make any criticism of Islam, the liberals will jump on you as a racist and all sorts of a terrible person. And I don't know what they're thinking, because obviously Islam, Sharia law, is not exactly going to be conducive to their ridiculous lifestyles. And so it's certainly a scary thing to me. And I mean, whenever I end up talking to someone who thinks like we do and they tell me that they're a parent, I feel compelled to say thank you for breeding, because yeah, I don't think yeah. enough people are doing this.
I know.
And it's scary because, you know, and speaking as somebody who's been involved in libertarianism for so long, I tend to think of, you know, hey, everybody just go do your thing sexually is how I would like to look at the world. But I am looking at it now and saying, like, you know, hey, can you stop with the birth control? I'm like, yeah. Can you stop with the birth control? Can you stop with the abortion? Like, we need to breed. We're being outnumbered here, and it's going to be it has the potential to be absolutely catastrophic. And, you know, I'm certainly looking at it, and for all my disagreements with the existence of the state apparatus and the way that it operates, I have said, hey, I like this Donald Trump guy. Go ahead, build your wall. Tell people to stop coming into the country. Let's stop the bleeding here. Because I do not want to, as a guy who does value his freedom, I do not want to be overrun by a civilization that does not value reason, that thinks that violence is a good way to solve problems, and does and will come in here and out breed and bleed us to the brink of extinction.
Right, but there's no differences between us, right? So it doesn't really matter, right? So I mean, I guess that's really the extent of the argument, or that we should help these people, whatever. I mean, it changes. I've said this before on the show, but it changes depending on what time we're in and who we're talking to. You know, in one instance, they are economic migrants. They come to the West for a better life. In the other instant, they flee from war, despite that now during the Syrian you know, conflict. We've had a tremendous amount of people from other countries outside of Syria that has jumped on the bandwagon and piggybacked on this issue to get into Europe, to get a free ride, basically. So that's one issue. And then you have other scenarios where it's us simply just helping them, or they're fleeing from war. It keeps changing. And then, as I said, the United Nations, they say that, well, you're not breeding, so we need to replace, you know, you need to be replaced, basically, or we need to bring in enough people to continue the infinite constant growth kind of concept that we've entered into economically right now, right? They believe, I mean, it seems to be the case, if you look at that United Nations report, that they literally believe there will be an ever-expanding population indefinitely, because there's no idea of, like, well, we can't just, you know, populations can't just keep growing and growing and growing for us just to take care of an economic situation. Resources will run out, etc. There's all these problems to it. So I think all of those are fairly flawed arguments in that sense, because they keep changing depending on them needing to convince us that we should agree to this. What do you think?
Well, I mean, with all of these people, you have this nonsense polylogism where they say, well, I'm going to make this argument for one policy that I want, and I'm going to make the exact opposite argument for another policy, right? So they think it's just a fantastic idea to subsidize birth control and abortion. And then they, on the same hand, say, well, we've got to import people because we're running out of human beings. You know, and part of this, I would say that a lot of this has to do with actually the monetary system, because, of course, you know, with central banking and this sort of thing, there's always more debt in the system than money in the system. And yeah. So you have this crazy economic system that's built on the idea that there's perpetual growth. And the second that there's any sort of decline, everything begins to fall apart. And so they have to do ridiculous, dangerous, crazy things in order to keep their stupid monetary scams afloat. And so they will do dangerous things like import massive amounts of people from ridiculous war-torn countries. Now, I think that, I hate to sound conspiratorial, but it occurs to me that when you're subsidizing a people's birth control and abortion, when you're raising their taxes, when you're doing everything in your power to discourage them from breeding, and then you're complaining that they're not breeding, and then you're replacing them with other people, it seems to me like there's an agenda.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
And this leads me down to. Again, I might be touching on subjects that you've probably talked about before, but it blows my mind. And I started looking into like the white genocide thing.
Sure.
And this, yeah. And this is what it looks like to me, is that there's an intentional effort. There's an intentional effort to wipe people out. And I feel like, you know, there's in the United States, at least in the state that I'm in New Hampshire, you know, we still have pretty good access to firearms. And there's all this effort to try to get your firearms away. And if you look at demographics and how people respond to talk about gun control, well, you find out that white people are the ones who want to keep their guns, and other people not so hot on the idea. And so it seems to me that there's an effort to replace us with I don't want to say more docile, because, of course, they'd like to replace us with blacks, and blacks are far from docile. But people who are more willing to go along with an ever expansive government.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I personally, I don't understand the aversion to calling it a conspiracy for what it is. I know that it's associated, the word, with a lot of things, but I mean,
just to clarify the reason that I have an aversion to it. So, like, you know, people will say conspiracy theory as a way to dismiss an entire class of information.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
And I don't like when people do that. So, like, you know, there's the, you know, we have 9/11 happens, and there's all sorts of ideas as to what happened there. And once you begin to entertain any alternative theory whatsoever, you're deemed a conspiracy theorist. If you don't believe every word of the 9/11 Commission report, well, then you're a conspiracy nut. You know, I'm not a right. guy who says that, you know, George Bush flew a missile into the building with a remote control. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I don't believe the government. I don't think that they tell me the truth. And of yeah. course, for this, I'm labeled a conspiracy theorist. You know, so I just, that's my aversion to using the word, is that people use it to dismiss information as opposed to exploring it.
Right. Well, exactly. When that's conspiracy theory as opposed to conspiracy reality, or just conspiracy, right? Because in criminal law, a conspiracy is defined simply as an agreement between two or more people. And you know, to commit a crime at some point in the future. And if we take that argument further and look at what actually it says in the UN report on population replacement, if we look at comments from You know, this the Kudenhof Kellerge, this one, you know, kind of ideological founder, really, of the European Union, who got together with the Habsburgs and to who, you know, he advocated for basically the replacement of the European people by, and this is his quote, to bring in a, you know, Eurasian Negroid race. That was his wording of how he defined this, of what he wanted to see. And his many of his ideas have actually come into fruition afterwards. For example, bringing in the anthem he proposed, the symbol or the, you know, the 12 stars that's on the flag and all this kind of thing. And there are people within the European Union today that actually get prizes from the Kudenhof Kellerge Foundation and stuff like that. So, you know, that's a real thing that's going on. So if we bring that back to the idea of conspiracy, and genocide, as you mentioned before, the idea of what the United Nations define genocide as is not only, you know, when you actually haul people away or murder them, but it's actually planning their demographic demise or replacing them and stuff like that. So, I mean, that goes right in line with what actually is going on here. So I don't shy away for calling it what it is, you know, Chris.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at there. And I mean, it's a thing that can be difficult to talk about, as with a lot of the subjects that you cover on here, because people do have this reaction to it. But at some point you say, you know, you're it's not a frivolous dot connecting exercise. I'm looking at a pattern of behaviors and policies that are specifically aimed at doing away with a certain segment of people. And of course, if we were to outline such a policy that we're going to do that to any other group of people, people would not react very well to that.
No,
not so long ago, we had there was trending on Twitter, open borders for Israel. And
yeah,
I thought that was really funny because, of course, that would never be tolerated, right? You just say, hey, open up the borders to Israel, and then a bunch of Muslims start pouring in there. And I don't imagine that Benjamin Netanyahu would think that that was a great idea. Meanwhile, he's condemning Donald Trump for shutting down Muslim immigration in the United States when he's not even in power yet.
No,
but Benjamin Netanyahu thinks he's really fit to comment on American immigration policy, but certainly does not want to have that sort of idea going on in his country.
Well, you know, this is the thing that you're touching upon here, that the double standards and the fact that, you know, they won't even admit any refugees into Israel. And they've openly said, some of them, that, well, you know, this would upset, our demographic. We're a small country, blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, Denmark and Norway are not small countries, you know, or even Sweden. I think there's more, Jews in Israel than there are Swedes right now. So, you know, there you go. And it's being pushed by us, in some cases by the Barbara Spectors and, you know, these people and all that. Actually, even recently, the Israel even banned a novel on Arab-Jewish romance from schools because it, quote, was threatening to Jewish identity, unquote. I mean, can you imagine if something like that was going on in our countries? Like this thing with the billboard, right, that was promoting Where White People Meet, that website. Right.
right. And everybody's panicking about this and everybody's saying it's just so racist. And meanwhile, you know, I had gone on my show. I mean, there's no shortage of dates specifically geared towards either interracial couples or geared towards Jewish peoples or geared towards Black people or Latinos. Every other possible imaginable sort of ethnic or racial or religious dating site is completely fine. But of course, you know, in Utah, of all places, you put up a sign that says wherewhitepeoplemeet.com and you got a picture of a good looking white couple. And, you know, white people themselves can't rush fast enough to condemn this thing. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, this is the point. You know, you basically cannot have any interests as a white person, as a European, Caucasian, call it what you want. That basically enables you to continue in carrying on your culture, your heritage, your ethnicity, your race, if you will. It's just out of the question, and that's the environment we're in right now. And it seems that many people are they're in a position where you can't bypass. There is like a, I don't know if firewall is the right word, but it's basically, even when you bring double standards to their attention, they still cannot accept it, right? Because they say, well, if white people want to be with white people, that's white supremacy. And they say, well, but all these other people are doing this and it's fine for them. Why not for whites? Well, because that's racist, right? And so, yeah, but the other people are doing it. Why does it apply to whites? Well, because that's racism and white supremacy. And it's like you can't peer into their logic, reasoning and get to that at these individuals. It's like there have been they've been programmed, you know, from culture, from education, from entertainment, and all these things, that they have no ability to see that it's a double standard, and what exists for others should be perfectly fine for us as a group as well, right?
Yeah, it's tragic what has gone on with the educational system, that people are not taught how to think, right? They're sort of just taught, they're memorizing a bunch of information and then turning around and regurgitating it. And that's tragic because, of course, anybody who had ever had an education that involved reason and logic would turn around and say that that was foundationally ridiculous. What you have now is this this thought process, or at least this it's catching on the idea that, okay, what they're trying to pitch racism as now is that, well, racism is power or privilege plus bias, right? You can have all the bias in the world, but right. As long as you don't have power and privilege, it's the dominant culture. Only the dominant culture, only the dominant privileged, powerful people can they be racist. And so this is what you have on the college campuses here in the United States, that they're demanding, you know, safe spaces, segregated housing for black and other racial and ethnic minority students. Whereas it's funny, I mean, they're doing this at University of Missouri, which in the United States was this whole thing concerned student 1950 was where the federal government came in and forced the school to integrate racially. When they didn't want to do this in the 1950s, they were like, no, this is a white school. I don't care what the federal government said. And the military came down and forced them to do it. And here we are in 2015 with a bunch of black students saying, we need safe spaces and we need segregated housing. And I'm like, look, if you want to go back to segregated schools, I'll join your cause. I think that would be fantastic. Let's have segregated schools so that we can have a white college and you can have a black college. And if somebody thinks it's a great market idea to have an integrated college, then, you know, have at it. But, you know, it seems to me that there's a great deal of market demand for homogenous educational facilities. So let's go ahead and do that. But of course, no black student says, well, white people should be able to have their own space. They say, no, we should have our own. What's yours is ours and what's mine is mine. And it's this one way street of, you know, screw whitey, frankly.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're truly coming full circle. You're right. We're actually looking in yesterday into, you know, Brown versus Board of Education and some of these some of these doll tests that were made as you know, proof actually presenting in court as to why, you know, segregation was bad on the black community and things like this. It was a very, very fraudulent, phony test, to be honest, very unscientific. But I guess it was emotional enough to convince, you know, some of the judges and whatnot. But what's funny about it is just what you say, that it's now going round back full circle, where you basically have a situation where they want to, you know, they feel uncomfortable with whites, right? So they need to be separate. They need to have their safe space. Let's segregate. But here's the caveat to this, though, right? That it still means that whites can't do it for the reason that I said before, which is, well, that would be racist, right? So it's white colleges or white industries, white countries, white neighborhoods for everybody, but, you know, with affirmative action, with, you know, diversity quotas and all this kind of stuff. But then the minorities within our countries, they are going to have the right to have their own specific colleges and industries and television channels and everything else. So it basically become us catering to everyone else and fulfilling, you know, the need of giving them things that we would deny to ourselves.
That's exactly where it's going, and it's incredibly frustrating because if you try to, as you mentioned, you know, you're trying to point this out to people, and they just panic and just, you know, smear you as an evil, racist, terrible person. And the only way that I can see to stop it is to be separate, right? And this obviously makes people very uncomfortable because if this is going to be a source of conflict for us, then, you know, then let's just not have the conflict. I'm very interested in, like, solving problems, right? And it doesn't seem to me that anybody is interested in resolving conflict. It seems to me like they're always trying to create more of it by, as we mentioned, you know, with the mass immigration, with the affirmative action and everything else. And it doesn't seem to me to be working out for either party. I mean, There was a court decision here recently, or a statement by a judge in a court decision about, you know, elevating blacks into colleges where they're not really intellectually suited to be, and it not panning out for them. And I just finished reading another book, Higher Superstition, The Academic Left and Their Quarrels with Science. It's an excellent read from the mid-90s about some of the ridiculous anti-science stuff that was going on there. And they talked about this even there, that you have these students who are coming into the educational facilities who do not have even the remedial education that they need to compete at a college level. And a lot of it is happening because they're put in there as a result of racial quotas. And they think that they're like helping out all parties involved. But what you end up with is just more conflict, more strife, more failure. And it's getting to a point where a college degree is almost a liability as opposed to an asset.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think Jared Taylor calls it, you know, basically irreconcilable difference, right? It's the legal foundation to grant a divorce, you know, and it's like, the more you try to force this, the more you push it together, the fallout from this, the conflict, the strife, the resources and time and effort that you have to spend on these issues of hyper-managing everything, of making everything, you know, absolutely fair and all the time. Well, I guess unless it's for white people, then it doesn't have to be fair. It just, you know, what it boils down to is you just remove whites out of the equation, and then you can call it diversity, and then that's great, right? So that's what that boils down to. But my point there is that, you know, I think segregation is something that occurs naturally anyway. If you look at how things are panning out in America, for example. It seems that that's kind of occurring on a natural basis. Then you have the government again coming in with programs like, you know, HUD and all that stuff, or trying to like find the most racist zip codes to actively place, you know, refugees and Section 8 housing and stuff like that in these neighborhoods that they consider to be racist. Again, you have to have a government in place that are actively at every turn are trying to hypermanage this situation to prevent people from, or to prevent whites, I guess, from actually segregating naturally on their own, because people ultimately, I think, prefer to be with their own, right?
Yeah, certainly. I do not know a whole bunch of well-to-do white liberals who want to go move into black neighborhoods. It's just not what happens, right? So all these people who want to scream racist at me when I try to point out some rather obvious glaring facts of the world do not go and move to Harlem. They don't go to try to, you know, diversify Saudi Arabia. They just claim that somebody else's neighborhood should have subsidized immigration. I mean, and you have this going on. I mean, in I want to say the name of the city is Hamtramck, Michigan, I believe it is. You know, they just elected their first, the country's first Muslim majority city council. And you have this phenomenon there. Everybody thought this was going to be fantastic, that they've just got all these immigrants coming in. And now they've got mosques, you know, all over the place that they play their prayer calls five times a day. And there are, you know, Polish people who are, you know, Allahu Akbar, whatever the call to prayer is, coming through their walls in the middle of the day. And you know what? They don't like it so much.
Right.
And so I do not see all of these people going out of their way to go into places where that's happening. They are like just wanted to go happen in somebody else's neighborhood is what it looks like to me.
It was not Dearborn, was it, in Michigan?
No, not. I believe the name of the city was Hamtramck.
Okay, yeah, that's another one then.
Some people will just refer to it as a part of Detroit, but it's technically outside of Detroit, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Well, yeah, I know Dearborn, Michigan. They have says a census in 2000, only 61.9% spoke English, while 29.3% spoke Arabic. It's another little, you know, colony basically of Muslims in Dearborn. But anyway, you know, Chris, we have much more to talk about. Many things I want to ask you about here as we pick up in a little bit in the second segment. We're going to take a short break here before that. But you know, please give us some of the details on how people can tune into your show. Give us some of the websites that you have, and just give us an idea how people can tune in.
Okay, so first things first, definitely follow me on Twitter. It's going to be a blast. Vote for Cantwell is the name of the Twitter handle there. And ChristopherCantwell.com is the primary blog, and I write there on a regular basis about a wide variety of subjects from race to economics to current events and self-defense and whatnot. And, of course, I do Radical Agenda. The show airs live 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. New York time. We air live on TuneIn and YouTube. You can catch that either at ChristopherCantwell.com or RadicalAgenda.com. It airs on, you can pick it up on Stitcher, iTunes, all the major podcast mediums as well.
Right, very good. We'll have the links up, of course. And yeah, so check that out, folks, if you want to hear more. A lot of good stuff coming out from the work of Chris Cantwell. So we'll take a short break right here, folks, and then we'll be back with more. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Chris. Be right back.
For without
Hour number two of the program we make available for members of Red Ice. First hour, always free, sometimes both. We spare you from commercial interruptions. And when you want to have full access, redicemembers.com is the website where you can sign up and tune in. You also have the full Radio 314 archive, including videos, inside episodes, and other films available in the member section as well. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds too, of course. Use a podcast app to download as many shows as you want to your mobile device. We have it broken up by year, so you have now 10 RSS feeds packed with Red Eyes Radio on a ton of different topics. We also list Radio 314 and our Insight and TV episodes in RSS feeds as well. Now, in the second hour, we branch out quite a bit too with Chris and speak more about how he sees the upcoming election in the U.S. panning out with, Trump, Hillary, and Bernie Sanders. We spend some time speaking about the reaction to all of this, as it's primarily taken shape within the alt-right, pros and cons with this, as he sees it. We speak about where to put this in the perspective of things to, get the most out of it, to see the benefits with it. It's an interesting second hour. I share some of my thoughts on this as well. I think you'll enjoy it. RedIceMembers.com. Thank you for listening. Now stay with us. Much more is coming up.